You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 21st of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. In the show ahead, NATO ministers are meeting in Brussels. We'll ask how significant it is that Russia will not be represented. Then,
cases are rising, and they could go yet as high as 100,000 a day. This pandemic is not over.
The British government says that COVID-19 is on the rise again and announces additional measures to curb the virus. Plus, China is suspected to have launched a new hypersonic missile. We'll unpack what that means for global security. We'll take a tour of Frankfurt Book Fair, flick through the papers, and...
You tell him I'm going to grind his fucking bones to make my bread.
He says he's going to grind your bones to make his bread.
Okay, tell him that I'm gonna run up off the fucking beanstalk.
We'll get some entertainment news, including the latest season of Succession. And then we'll find out why Facebook may be changing its name. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. European Union leaders will tackle their Polish counterpart at a summit today over a court ruling that questioned the primacy of European laws. Melbourne, a city of 5 million, will come out of lockdown today after spending a cumulative 262 days, or nearly 9 months, under stay-at-home orders since March 2020. And a new trade deal between the UK and New Zealand is expected to boost New Zealand's GDP by $970 million. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, NATO defence ministers are meeting today and tomorrow at their headquarters in Brussels. Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg said the gathering will be taking decisions to strengthen security and laying the ground for the NATO summit in Madrid next June. Well, this comes as Moscow said it would halt the activities of its diplomatic mission to NATO after the Western military alliance expelled 8 Russians, saying they were spies. Elizabeth Rohr is resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a columnist for foreign policy. She joins me on the line now. Elizabeth, can we start with this Russia row which blew up on Monday? What happened?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, 8 Russian diplomats were expelled. And this is something that typically happens when the host country or host organization, as is the case with the United Nations, NATO and so forth, when they determine that those diplomats or those people working under diplomatic passports that they are really spies. Often they obviously know that they are spies, but if they go beyond the pale in spying, then the host country or host organization may decide to expel them, which is what happened in this case. And we should remember that something that for example Margaret Thatcher did back in the 80s when she decided that was just too much Soviet espionage in the UK. Everybody knew, of course, I mean, every country spies on every other country, but it has to be within certain limits. And she decided it was too much and expelled a bunch of Soviet so-called diplomats who were really spies. And that's what happened. And then Russia inevitably responded by saying it's going to significantly reduce its interaction with NATO on the sort of working level. And that's where we are now.
So how effective can the meeting this week be without Russian involvement?
Yeah, so NATO ministerial meetings are really for NATO ministers, and the Russian presence was a diplomatic presence. So if you think about NATO headquarters, there is a part of NATO where the NATO member states sit, and there is another part where partners sit. And for many years, that was essentially Sweden, Finland, and Russia. And now Russia will suspend its activities there. So it's not like Russia would have been participating at the NATO ministerial meeting deciding strategy, but it's suspending its presence at NATO headquarters. And that's I think, very unfortunate, because it means that there won't even be that that working level, that the diplomat level interaction between Russia and NATO, and that is very unfortunate. And as part of that arrangement, there are usually, and there have been over the years, high-level meetings involving Russian officials and NATO officials. And let's see how this evolves. But the next time such an opportunity comes around, there won't be anybody to organize it at NATO. So we won't, as a result of this working level suspension of contacts, we won't have top-level dialogue within NATO, and that is very unfortunate.
So looking at the agenda for the next couple of days, Jens Stoltenberg told a press conference that future conflicts will be fought not just with bullets and bombs, but also with bites and big data. So can you tell us more about the alliance's efforts to future-proof?
Yeah, so I don't think it's a surprise to anybody that conflicts, that wars are changing. It's no longer so much about territorial conquest. It's much more about harming countries in other ways. And we are seeing it every single day in our countries. We are seeing cyber attacks, disinformation, diplomatic coercion, hostage diplomacy, punishment of companies as proxies for their governments and so forth. So it really goes on every single day. The question is what NATO should do about it. NATO is a military alliance, and that is NATO's existential struggle at the moment. It is a phenomenally successful military alliance, and it should keep focusing on military defense, obviously, because nobody else does it for the West. But as a result of it being so successful, there is this tendency among member states and others to say, well, NATO should do this, this, and this, and this as well. Because nobody else really is in charge of it, no international body, no alliance. And that's essentially where ministers are today. And yes, they will discuss space, threats in space, potential attacks on NATO member states and NATO itself using space, and of course, the ubiquitous cyber threats. But I think that the risk is for NATO to become all things to all people, and for people to just, countries to just assume that NATO will look after every sort of defense against every sort of threat. And that's a really fine balance the alliance and these ministers will have to strike.
So Afghanistan is bound to come up. What's the line on that likely to be?
That is another extremely tricky situation. I think every single NATO member state is struggling with whether and under which conditions to recognize the Taliban. Every country realizes that it's not sustainable not to accept a country that is likely to cause a lot of grief. I mean, you have to deal with somebody in that country, even if you don't like the government. NATO is, through various ways, continuing to try to get people out of Afghanistan and working, for example, with Pakistan to try to get some of the most vulnerable people who couldn't be evacuated in August to get them to safety. And just yesterday, NATO's senior civilian representative was in Islamabad having talks with Pakistan's chief of the army to get Pakistan's help and try to get more people out and in general establish more stability in the region. So that's where things stand at the moment. Obviously, the mission is over for NATO in Afghanistan. And so it doesn't really need to do very much. It has no mission or task at the moment. But of course, it's in everybody's interest that Afghanistan not become a source of instability in the region, because then it would be a bad thing for the region and by extension for NATO member states.
You mentioned that Finland and Sweden join in a diplomatic capacity, and I understand that on the second day of the meeting, that's tomorrow, they will join them, and the EU will also join to talk about further collaboration. What shape might that take?
Yes, there is intense collaboration already between Sweden and Finland on one hand and NATO on the other hand, and of course NATO also cooperates with the European Union. That's a bit more of an uneasy relationship, NATO and the European Union, because as we all know, the European Union has ambitions of becoming a stronger militarily those ambitions have been around since the 50s and have never really come to fruition. But nevertheless, the European Union keeps trying, and some people see that as competition with NATO. But on the other hand, it's so far from becoming a reality that NATO doesn't need to be that worried. And also, we should remember that most NATO member states are also EU member states. It's undefined at the moment how much responsibility militarily the European Union should have and what NATO's responsibilities should be. Or rather, NATO's responsibilities are clear. Those of the European Union are less clear. That's where things stand with the European Union. And Sweden and Finland, they are de facto members of NATO. It's like cohabiting rather than being married. They do a lot of things with NATO. They send troops to various NATO activities. They send troops to Afghanistan, for example. But they are not members, which means they don't have a say. And that's the uncomfortable situation of countries that could become members of NATO but have decided for domestic reasons not to become members of NATO. They get to contribute, and Sweden has lost a few soldiers in Afghanistan, for example. They sort of pay the price of working with NATO without having a say. And as a result, in those countries, many people say, well, what is the point of not being a member? Let's just be members and have a say as well. But there is no permanent majority in those countries for becoming members at the moment. Mm.
And finally, Elizabeth, just briefly, we know that China is obviously becoming increasingly aggressive. What's NATO's plan to block Beijing's belligerence?
That is a really tricky task for NATO, because China is belligerent in lots of ways that are not military. And if it's not military, then it's not NATO's responsibility, as we discussed previously. So what NATO can do, apart from its member states making their presence known in global waters, for example, and conducting freedom of navigation activities, which is when you sail through international waters just to make your presence known, there isn't really very much NATO can do. It can show that it's determined to defend itself. It can signal to China that it can't be bullied. But in terms of what China does today with hostage diplomacy, with IP theft, with coercion of companies, that's really far outside NATO's responsibilities. And that is precisely the challenge. We have an alliance that's very good at military defence, but what we need now is defence of a completely different kind.
Elizabeth, thank you very much indeed. That's Elizabeth Brough there. British Health Secretary Savid Javid gave a press conference yesterday as cases of COVID-19 increase in the country. Vincent McAvinney, political reporter and regular Monocle 24 voice, was following closely and joins me in the studio now. Vincent, what are the latest figures?
Well, yesterday there were an additional 49,139 cases and sadly another 179 deaths within 28 days of testing positive. And that was the eighth successive day of having over 40,000 new cases of COVID-19. So we are right back to the sort of levels that we were seeing in March when the country was very much in a lockdown.
So what did Javid announce?
Well, he didn't really announce much. I think this was a warning shot across the bow, a little bit of kind of tenderising the public for what's to come. Because he effectively, for Plan B, there are three parts to it. And the first part is actually signalling that we might need to step up what we're doing. And so what he was saying was trying to encourage people to make sure that they got their vaccines, if they hadn't yet, still got their second, to get their second, but also for the over 50s to go ahead and get that booster shot, which is a message, I think, that hasn't been getting pumped through clear enough in terms of the communication from government. There really is at the moment a kind of all hands on deck focus to try and turn around COP, the climate meeting in Glasgow, from being a bit of a disaster. And I think they've slightly slackened away too much from the messaging. But we are seeing now a split situation across England, because we've got Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland, where masks are still compulsory, where they're doing things in Scotland like the COVID passports, and Plan B, which is what kind of Sajid Javid is hoping he doesn't have to do. But what I think yesterday was being threatened is that to say to people, look, it's better to wear masks, but it's not compulsory, all these kind of things, trying to give it to people softly so that they can turn around next week and say, well, we did warn you, you didn't do this again, so now we're activating the plan. And like Scotland, like Northern Ireland, you're going to have masks in England and COVID passports, and it's your fault, you forced our hand.
And what did he say about a new variant?
Well, there is this tracking of a mutation, it said, of the Delta variant, which is the kind of dominant variant here. And he did say that it is under analysis right now. He didn't sort of go too much into that, though. He was talking about the new treatments that the UK is now investing in and bringing on board, sort of talking about how much the link between the hospitalisation and deaths has been cut. But he did say that the analysis at the moment is that the vaccinations we currently have are effective against this slight mutation on the Delta variant.
In terms of new treatments, there are two new antiviral drugs.
Yeah, that is right. And the government is bringing these on board, it says. So what the antivirus task force has secured 480,000 of drug called Molnupiravir, which trials found cut hospitalisation admissions or deaths by about half. And they are bringing on board a couple of 100,000 of another one, which is undergoing clinical trials. So this is still not something for a kind of really mass rollout, but these are new kinds of therapies that they're trying to see whether or not that will help. Because the real danger that they've got now is the NHS is once again running hot, and they will activate Plan B, they say, when the NHS is coming under strain. We are seeing rising hospital admissions. We have the highest cases in Europe at the moment. We're not near the US, which is really way up still on hospital admissions. But what we are seeing, apart from COVID, is people having really bad colds, flus. We've got really strong norovirus going around in the UK. After that 18 months of sheltering away, many people's immune systems aren't quite as strong as they were before. And we've also got some pretty nasty things about this year. I myself had that cold last week and it really wasn't fun. It's taken quite a while to get over it.
I think I've got it now.
Oh, God.
but Javid's been really criticised by all sorts of people, including the British Medical Association, for being reluctant to implement Plan B.
Yeah, and it seems, you know, the criticism is that all of the lessons that we didn't learn that were specifically mentioned last week in that document, which said that the UK moved too slowly to do things like lockdown, that when it was recognised it was needed, there was still too much delaying, that there is that delay. So Dr. Chand Nagpal, who's the BMA chairman, has said that the time is now, that doctors are under too much pressure. So there was criticism from the government and talking about that comparison to the rest of Europe. But I think what's interesting is you have to separate out the fact that we now actually have a new health secretary. Sajid Javid lost his job just before the pandemic as chancellor because of fights with Dominic Cummings behind the scenes. And now he's back. He replaced Matt Hancock as the health secretary. But he has been trying to play a little bit of a game with this, a bit of COVID's in the past. I'm a cool new health secretary. You don't need to wear masks. He said he wouldn't wear a mask himself on a crowded train unless the cases got up to like 100,000 a day. He was criticised for that tweet and had to apologise, where he said enough cowering from the pandemic and the families of those who were lost came out and absolutely criticised, saying that their relatives weren't cowering. And so I think what's interesting with Sajid Javid, and it's something to watch, is this is someone who has real career ambitions. This is someone who wants the leadership of the Conservative Party next, who some ways had his apprentice, Rishi Sunak, who was kind of his deputy at the Treasury, sort of usurp him during that time, and he had such a massive profile in the pandemic. And now he's back at top-line politics, and I think he is keeping an eye on the future. And I think very much with Sajid Javid, he likes to throw a bit of red meat to the kind of Tory heartlands, that sort of libertarian side. And I think he's trying to play a little bit of a game to them, saying, oh, yeah, I'm not going to be like Matt Hancock, Mr. Rules, and, you know, the hypocrisy of it all. I think he's trying to play a little bit cool to his own side, because he has this kind of slight issue, I think, when it comes to the Conservative Party, where, you know, he's someone who, because of his background and race, he's trying always to kind of show that he really is one of them and he gets it.
Yeah. Yeah. And finally, Vincent, just briefly, half-term is coming up. And against that background, Morocco has now cancelled all flights to and from Britain. I mean, are we likely to see this happen more and more? And are half-term holiday plans ruined?
Well, I think there'll be a lot of countries nervously watching the UK and wondering whether, you know, now that they've got the summer season out of the way, whether it is worth, you know, heading into the winter, allowing Brits to come in if this rate keeps on climbing. And I think it will be a reaction. They might be waiting to see what happens with Plan B, but I don't know. I think at the moment there's a bit of a funny dance going on because of COP, you know, the UK very much wanting to get all the focus onto that. And I don't think that they'll make any moves into Plan B before kind of COP happens, because it looked very awkward with world leaders coming and mixing whilst at the same time telling everyone to work from home, which is part of Plan B, wear masks. There was a suggestion as well that it might include a now move that households shouldn't mix as well. So a kind of, you know, not locking down the economy again because the, you know, the massive bills that would cause and the problems for businesses. But I think that we'll see. Given the October half term is kind of this week, next week, it is the October weeks. I think we're not going to see anything that might then trigger other countries to reassess their position on the UK.
Vincent, thank you very much indeed. That's Vincent McAvinney there. Now, still to come on the programme, we'll look at China's new hypersonic weapon. We'll get a taste of the Frankfurt Book Fair, find out why Facebook might be changing its name, and...
I dropped a bomb. The whole world is watching for my next move.
You're the number one trending topic ahead of Tater Tots, and the Pope followed you.
Wow.
Okay, no, this is not the... is this the real...
Right.
No,
great.
I don't
Thanks,
think
Greg.
This is a Pope.
My family have disappeared. I need to know where everyone is and what everyone's
doing. Hurrah! There's a new series of Succession. We'll be talking about that a little bit later on. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Reports have emerged that China recently launched a hypersonic missile with nuclear capability. This has been denied by Beijing, who claim it was a test of reusable technology that could reduce the cost of launching a spaceship. Michael Clark is a security expert and the former head of RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute. He joins me on the line now. Michael, what is a hypersonic missile and how does it differ from an intercontinental ballistic missile?
Yes, a hypersonic missile is very fast, and so it doesn't go, as it were, up into the into space and then come down again. It goes up into the upper atmosphere, where it can circle the whole of the world, circumnavigate the globe, and then glide down. And so it has speeds of about five times the speed of sound. That's about 4,000 miles an hour, and it's able to maneuver while it's on the way down. That's what makes it a hypersonic missile. It's very fast. It is almost impossible to defend against. It can, as it were, if it's gliding around the world, it can come down at any point. So it's not clear where the attack may have originated from. And it can carry either a conventional or a nuclear warhead. So it's a new generation of missiles, which is just very, very hard to defend against.
Well, Beijing has denied it, though. And given that China recently launched a second three-person crew to staff its space station, could this be a credible explanation?
No. No. Nobody. I mean, all of the intelligence agencies around the world, they're watching this very, very carefully. And the Chinese don't expect us to believe what they say. They conducted two tests. One might have been in late July or maybe early August. The second one we've seen since August. There's very reliable information for that. So we know that they've conducted two tests. They're some way ahead of the United States on this. The US is very worried because the US is developing its own hypersonic technologies, but it's not this far ahead. So the Chinese are certainly 3 or 4 years ahead of the United States on this. But clearly that is what they're doing. It is a potential, we shouldn't be too dramatic about it, but it changes the nature of the balance of major weapon systems between the great powers.
And you talk about intelligence watching this very closely, but they do seem to have been a little taken by surprise.
Yes, I mean they have to put together a lot of information. So evidence of a test can occur because a trace is seen, and then you're not quite sure what the test is, and so a lot of data has to come together. Most of it electronic data. It isn't, you can't actually see these things happening most of the time, although there may be a little bit of that from spy satellites. And then the data is, when the whole thing comes together, then it's a very, very closely guarded secret. And by the time it gets into the press, 2 or 3 weeks later, then the intelligence communities around the world have known about it for some time. So it did take them by surprise because nobody thought the Chinese were quite this far ahead. It looks as if their second test, as it were, was 90% successful. They got one of their hypersonic missiles to fly all the way around the world, but then it missed its target. Which is a minor problem in a way, because they will get that right. Funnily enough, the hardest bit in hypersonic technology is getting the glide vehicle, that the vehicle that, as it were, goes round in the upper atmosphere and then just comes down almost at a predetermined point. Because of there are so many stresses, there's so much heat involved, so much speed involved, that the final guidance system is the hard bit. So getting it to hit its target accurately is much harder for a hypersonic missile than it is for a conventional ballistic warhead. But they will get that right at some point.
And what about the timing of this test? Is that significant?
Not especially. I think the Chinese wanted to test it as soon as they could. If they'd wanted to make a big splash with this test, then they would have announced it and they would have said more about it. They knew we would find out, of course. The political circumstances surrounding this tells me that they were going ahead with the testing program as fast as they could because they want to have this weapon before anybody else. And therefore, by the time other people catch up, they'll be a little bit further ahead in the refinement of the weapon. It's a classic arms race in the sense that you end up racing against yourself. Every time you develop a new weapon, you then therefore develop a sort of defense against it. So then you develop it even further. And that's what the Chinese are doing. They're, in a sense, they're racing against themselves to try to stay ahead where they've got a lead in this fairly new technology.
And you say the US is developing this too. Are other countries also trying to produce hypersonic weapons?
The Russians have, yes. They boast in 2019, they boasted that they had two. One called the Avangard, and the other, if I remember, was called the Kinzhal weapon, which was a bit slower. But the Avangard certainly looks as if they tested a couple of times. One of the tests went disastrously wrong and caused a big explosion. The engine blew up and caused a great deal of damage and loss of life. The Russians tried to cover that up, but they've been testing fairly vigorously. Certainly not flight testing, but ground testing since about 2019. The United States has been moving on this more quickly since about 2010, 2012, but undoubtedly we will now see a lot more U.S. tests. I think the U.S. is really keen to speed up its program because the Chinese are spurring it on. This is a bit like 1957 when the Russians first launched a satellite, the Sputnik, in 1957. It frightened the daylights out of America. And by 1961, the Americans had overtaken them. So now that the Chinese have launched their hypersonic weapons, the Americans will be desperate to catch up.
Mm. So just looking at the ballistic missile defense, the BMD of the US, I mean, there are various experts who say that this is not a game changer, that it wasn't designed to counter China's existing missiles. And in fact, there's one point of view which says that this comes from Vipin Narang, who's a professor of nuclear security and political science at MIT. He says one reason why the US pursues counterforce and missile defense capabilities is precisely to force adversaries to invest a lot of time and resources to develop crazy experimental systems. This is a feature, he says, not a bug of US strategy.
Yes, well, I think if he was honest, he would admit that is the effect. But it's not. It wasn't really an American strategy. They discovered by accident, in a way, when Ronald Reagan pronounced the Star Wars program in 1983. that suddenly it convinced the Soviet Union that they wouldn't be able to keep up. And the Star Wars program more or less failed. It always was going to fail, but it frightened the Russians into deciding that they couldn't compete. So it may be that one effect of America's defense systems, which are now much more sophisticated, is to do that, to push the adversaries. I think they've got Russia more in mind than China, actually, into expensive arms races, which they then give up. But I don't think there's any indication that the Chinese are going to give up. The Russians might have to, but China believes that this is their century, that history is on their side, and that they are not going to be put off by America's defense, even though American defensive systems are really quite good. And we have to admit that the hypersonic glide vehicles, when they re-enter the atmosphere or the lower Earth atmosphere, they're bigger than a warhead from an ICBM. They're hotter. They're slower. So conventional existing defense systems might be able to pick some of them up. But equally, if you've got enough of these hypersonic missiles flying around, they certainly won't be able to pick up more than three or four.
Michael, thank you very much indeed. Here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. European Union leaders will tackle their Polish counterpart at a summit today over a court ruling that questioned the primacy of European laws. Member states, such as France and the Netherlands, are keen to prevent their government's cash contributions to the EU from benefiting socially conservative politicians undercutting human rights. The Polish Prime Minister is set to defend Poland, stating that elements of EU law are incompatible with the country's constitution. Millions in Melbourne are readying to come out of the world's longest COVID-19 lockdown later today, with pubs, restaurants and cafes rushing to restock supplies before opening their doors. Prime Minister Scott Morrison confirmed the state had reached the target percentage of double vaccinated citizens. The city of 5 million will have spent a cumulative 262 days, or nearly 9 months, under stay-at-home orders since March 2020. And a new trade deal between the UK and New Zealand goes beyond economic provisions. The historic new UK-New Zealand free trade deal includes commitments from the UK to protect New Zealand's iconic haka kaumate. The deal is expected to boost New Zealand's GDP by $970 million and will hopefully curb appropriation of the traditional Maori war dance. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. The Frankfurter Buchmesse is the most important international trade fair for publishing and content of all kinds, from novels and children's books to scientific databases. Experts from global publishing meet partners from the technology industry and related creative industries, such as film and games. It's the hub of the international rights and licensing trade, as well as a major cultural event, attracting literature enthusiasts and making Frankfurt the centre of the international media world in October. The fair opened yesterday, and our Monocle Düsseldorf correspondent Marie-Sophie Schwarzer is there. Marie, what's the atmosphere been like? Are people excited for the return to face-to-face?
Everyone is very, very excited to be back at the Frankfurter Buchmesse in person after last year's online-only event. And fittingly, the motto is Reconnect. 2,000 exhibitors from 80 countries and more than 300 international authors have gathered on the German fairground, which I must add is significantly less than the 7,450 exhibitors of 2019. Nonetheless, it's a very promising sign for the industry. And when I spoke with Jürgen Boos, the director of the Frankfurter Buchmesse, he was very, very optimistic and described the era as the golden age of publishing. And he's just so excited for everyone to be together again. And this year around, it's opening to the public earlier than usual on Friday afternoon already. So everyone will be able to get to go and meet authors, take part in talks. So it is very wonderful to have this event live on the physical fairgrounds again.
As you say, the numbers are slightly down on 2019. I wonder if you've observed any other changes.
Of course, everyone has to comply with the COVID regulations. So stands are more spacious, halls and aisles are larger as well so that people can keep that distance. People are running around in masks. The guest of honor this year is Canada, and they were last year as well, but they were given the opportunity again this year to really engage with the public. And they're the first in history to have a virtual pavilion, which you can access online from wherever you are in the world. And they also have the physical pavilion at the book fair. And they've had to create so many different iterations of their showcase, of their pavilion, because they've had to comply with the changing regulations. So their first design is very different from their final design. And when you walk into the space now, it's very big and you have a lot of space to walk. You're following a little red line that guides you through mountain landscapes that they've created. It's really, really moving, because you have music, you have poetry in indigenous languages, and you have virtual elements as well as talks with authors and lots of different showcases that they have. But that really shows you how much people had to be flexible to change things around to really make it work this year. And of course, not as many people were able to visit from international destinations because of regulations regarding testing and quarantine rules.
You say that Canada has made use of Indigenous languages, and I wonder how else they're using that platform, that status of guest of honour, to promote what's important to them. I guess migrant literature authors also feature there.
Yes, it's a really diverse showcase that they have. They have 58 authors, 8 of which are at the fair in person. Unfortunately, not everyone could be there. But at the opening ceremony, Vivek Shraya, an award-winning trans writer, also a musician, filmmaker, and visual artist, gave a really wonderful speech about how, you know, instead of advising people to be yourself, we should advise people to be yourselves, because your true self is always evolving. And then Mary May Simon, Canada's first Indigenous Governor General, was there and gave an emotional speech, and she talked about how her grandmother loved to tell her legends, which she called creation myths. And she said that she believes all our stories are creation myths, and how we need to nurture and protect our stories and storytellers. And she also spoke of the thousands of Indigenous lives that have been lost, and how there is no easy way to heal those wounds, but that stories have the power to bring us all closer together.
And Marie-Sophie, what conversations are being had about the future of publishing?
The future of publishing is, I must say, everyone is very, very optimistic. And of course, everyone was talking about last year, the pandemic, when that hit. People were worried at first, but it turns out it was a very good year for the publishing industry, and more people picked up a book. According to the GSK survey, around 25% more people picked up books. So people did return to reading, and even though bookshops struggled, the publishing industry itself really saw a lot of growth. And on stage, Marco Stola, the CEO of Penguin Random House, listed a number of reasons why he thinks this is actually the best time in publishing since Gutenberg invented the printing press. And he said, number one, the revenue pool of the industry is growing every year and end consumers are annually spending more money on books. Number two, the publishing industry has a stable and robust business model encompassing print and digital. The industry has found a healthy coexistence between print and digital. About 80% is print, 20% digital, and that has really stabilized the book ecosystem. And he also said that the audience is growing with the world population expanding and literacy rates going up. And then again, books for children and young adults have been the fastest growing categories, introducing new generations to books. So you're constantly growing your customer base. So he really, really said that it's the best time to be in publishing.
And finally, the event's got another 3 days to run. What are you most looking forward to?
Yes, the event is running until Sunday and opening to the public on Friday afternoon. And there are lots of different highlights, really. What's new this year is the Frankfurt Studio Inside Publishing, which has a stage on the fairgrounds, but is also available online, so anyone from anywhere can listen to really interesting debates and discussions and talks happening on that stage. There are around 50 events happening throughout Frankfurt in different locations, really bringing the program out into the city. The AED Book Fair stage in the Festhalle is also a really interesting place and will present about 75 events throughout the week. And they have been working on a project that is also a lead theme at the Frankfurter Buchmesse, and that is, how do we want to live our lives? They're kind of answering that question through various talks, and they've also worked on a documentary where they put 8 people on a boat to discuss this question. So that will be really interesting to see.
Marie-Sophie Schwarzer, our Dusseldorf correspondent, thank you very much indeed for that. The Frankfurt Book Fair runs until the 24th of October.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and we'll continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me down the line is Alessio Patalano, professor at King's College London. Good morning to you, Alessio.
Good morning, Georgina.
What's going on with fuel prices in Singapore?
This is an interesting piece because it kind of like helps us putting in a broader context, a broader perspective, the sort of energy challenges that certainly have been hitting the UK quite remarkably over the past few weeks. But it's really not just a UK phenomenon. And here we're talking about Singapore. The Singaporean economy relies entirely on imported energy, particularly liquefied natural gas. And what you're seeing happening in Singapore, which I'm sure for many in the audience who are familiar with the place, it's quite a sort of energy demanding place, given the fact that a lot of the activities there really rely on that continuous power supply, and being also one of the most advanced, if you want, realities in the broader Indo-Pacific region. It's quite remarkable that you've seen the article sort of makes quite clear that smaller energy companies are going through a very difficult period of time because of the surge in the prices natural gas. There's a lot of concern among small and medium businesses in Singapore about how they will afford and they will continue to operate throughout the winter. So it's a very interesting piece because it tells us, you know, even down in Southeast Asia, well beyond the boundaries, if you want, of the European context, the surge in prices are creating quite a considerable earth-shaking moment, if you want, the world over.
Talking of earth-shaking moments, I'm sure he would like this to be regarded as such. Former President Donald Trump has announced that he'll launch his own social media app and news company to compete with big tech. Tell us more.
Exactly. So this has been announced over the last few hours, really, and international headlines are starting to pick this one up. Here, the Independent has run a story about it. It's going to be called Truth, which...
irony.
The irony of this, exactly. I mean, Georgina, you start reading about it and it really sort of gives you a chill down the spine because it very much resonates with all the sort of worries and concerns that the way in which the former president managed the truth when he was in power. So imagine having a platform on his own terms. Now, what is interesting is that the current plans are for a soft rollout and then for a fully fledged sort of opening of this new platform next spring. And what is interesting is really that you got a sense that he's going to be trying to get a sense of what sort of reactions, what kind of space this platform can become. And it is also interesting. There is perhaps an ideal point in time, if you're someone like Trump, to launch this type of activity, given all that we know of the growing doubts and questions raised against the monopoly of some of the big social media tech, in particular sort of Facebook. So he might very well find fertile ground to launch this new operation, the consequences of which, in more ways than ones, at the moment are all but clear, but certainly will raise new important questions of what the truth is and how you manage it in contemporary sort of societies.
Absolutely, and we'll be talking about all those problems Facebook is facing towards the end of the programme. Very quick look now at the Korea Herald.
Yes. So, I mean, this is an interesting story because, you know, Korea has been, South Korea has been relatively a slow burner when it comes to the launching of heavier satellites in orbit. And given the fact that over the past few weeks, we've heard so much about the recent missile tests that North Korea was conducting, it's interesting that today what we are hearing about is not North Korea, but for once is actually South Korea. Was going to be launching one of its rockets this afternoon. Well, afternoon in Korea time, anyway. And if successful, really mark a very important point. South Korea joining that small club of countries that can launch heavier satellites in space. Also suggesting that the commitment of the past few years, South Koreans to develop the basic means and technology to join sort of the capacity at the very least to increase their monitoring and surveillance activities in addition to sort of wider considerations on technology from space. That moment is coming and that moment is likely to be this afternoon.
Alessio, thank you very much indeed. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. It's time now to find out what's making headlines in the world of entertainment. And the film critic Karen Krasanovich joins me in the studio. Karen, I'm so excited. Succession.
I know. It's back at long last. We've only had to wait a whole pandemic. Oh, wait a minute. What am I saying? Yes, indeed. Are you a fan?
Oh, I'm a huge fan. Mm. And you know what's really great for me is that it was coming up on the programme today. And so I could actually sit down and watch it without feeling guilty because I was doing my homework.
Wonderful, wonderful. So what are your first impressions?
Oh, I thought it was amazing. And do you know what? I will never, ever forget the line from Kendall, fuck the weather, we're changing the cultural climate. I thought that was just genius. And I think that's what's genius about it. It's the writing. It's Jesse Armstrong.
The writing is incredible, actually. Now this is Series 3, written by Jesse Armstrong, as the other two are. And they're loosely based, now if you haven't watched Succession, you're missing out. It's loosely based on Murdoch, but also the Redstones, the Mercers, and Conrad Black. These are global companies that have children tipped as the successors, but nobody's really been named yet. So this is what the fascination about Succession is. It's I like to think of it as sort of Dynasty without the shoulder pads, but that's such an old reference. Or maybe The Sopranos without the nice stuff. You know, really, it is about family politics and corporate politics. And it's huge. It's a huge award winner. It's cleaned up at the Emmys last year. And also Logan Roy, the patriarch played by Brian Cox, won a Golden Globe for its last season.
I'm just really not surprised. And you know, when you look when you look back at Jesse Armstrong's work, I mean, the other line that I will never forget that he wrote was
so
difficult,
many.
Difficult, lemon difficult.
The one I like that was actually in the trailer, and you can see it says, I'm better than you. You're corrupt, evil. That's Kendall Roy, played by Jeremy Strong, who's Brian Cox's son, who in the first, I won't spoil anything, who in the series, the end of series two, was exposing the company as being corrupt and his father as well. And the father goes, don't talk about things you don't understand. So he understands corruption and evil. Oh, good.
Just a tip to people who do like Jesse Armstrong's writing. He's got a novel out. Actually, it's been out for a while. I think it came out in 2016. It's called Love, Sex and Other Foreign Policy Goals. And you can hear a conversation that I had with him about that book and about the rest of his work on our Meet the Writers archive. So do go and have a look at that if you have a moment. Right. There are other things
hardly. I mean, really, there's, you know, no, we won't talk about the Yahtzee strike and we won't talk about the box office, but we can talk about, what do you want to talk about?
How about David Chappelle and Netflix?
Dave Chappelle, yes, yes. Getting into a lot of hot water. Now, Dave Chappelle, of course, is kind of taking over the mantle from George Carlin, long late lamented, as being the controversial comedian who can get away with a lot of stuff. And his Netflix special, The Closer, was called by a recent San Francisco report as exhausting, transphobic, and grievous field rant. Exposed as a comedy. So anyway, Netflix has quite a few of Dave Chappelle's comedy specials, and they actually fired a black trans employee who was helping to organize the walkout that happened last night, also accusing them of leaking financial data about the cost of the special. Now, the special apparently cost $24 million, and that would include marketing, of course. And I mean, Chappelle doesn't get all of that. But the trouble is that Chappelle is not only... his whole style is goading people, but he's come out on the side of J.K. Rowling and Margaret Atwood that gender constructs are real. Now, you know, if you do that, you're going to be opening a can of worms. So about 1,000 employees, supporters and other people were at a rally last night around the Los Gatos site of the company. And there were some physical clashes between Chappelle supporters and people that walked out of Netflix. And one a protester apparently had their sign torn up, leaving the other one with only a stick. that sounds funny, but actually the tensions are running quite high. And there was a virtual walkout as well last night. I don't have any figures on that, but people were saying, I'm not going to watch Netflix because of this.
Wow. I mean, this is such a contentious issue, isn't it? And I wouldn't be at all surprised if Netflix just wants to get as far away from that as possible.
Yeah, well, they are, but they're also supporting Chappelle, and they're saying, and then there's a Canadian commentator said, you know, in Canada, we don't have this kind of law, but in America, you can pretty much say what you want. Mm. And there is this sort of moral issue about what can you say, what's funny, and what can't you say. And this is something that's not new, but it's particularly interesting in this regard because Netflix third quarter report's quite high.
Yeah. Quick look at The Continental.
Yes. Okay. The Continental. Now, if you've watched any of the John Wick films, and you probably have because they've grossed more than $300 million, the fourth film is coming soon in May next year. It's being shot right now in Budapest, and Mel Gibson is coming on board as a support character, a new character called Cormac. Now, The Continental is set in 1975 New York, and it is the hotel for assassins. So if you're an assassin, you can do whatever you like, but once you get inside the hotel, you can't kill anybody. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like the opposite of Only Murders in the Building. Anyway, Gibson hasn't really done that much television. He's been in Australian series in the 70s, but mostly his film roles have been famous. He's also an Oscar-winning director, and also quite well-known for anti-Semitic and racist comments that he's said over the various years. So what I think is interesting about this is that controversy attracts eyeballs. Whether you like him or you don't, you're going to want to see what he's doing. And in a way, it kind of mirrors what's going on with Netflix.
Absolutely. I mean, do you think that the reason that we haven't really seen him on our screens recently is because he was, in quote marks, cancelled, and now he's not in a lead in this. He is a secondary character.
Yeah, well, he has been doing a lot of independent stuff, very low profile things. I think he is quite a hot topic. I think people want us to just stay away from him. He was an amazing leading man in his heyday, which is a kind of a mean thing to say, but he still is a skilled actor and a skilled director, and I think maybe this is just a litmus test to see if what the public thinks of him. And I think it's quite a wise move because he can deliver the goods.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Karen, thank you so much for coming on. And I'm just one last thing before we go about Succession. They're drip feeding us. I tried to watch the whole thing last night. You could only see one at a time.
No, people are not happy about that. But as you're in the media, you probably would get a few more episodes. But it just means that we've got more time to listen to your interview.
Karen, thanks very much for joining us. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. There are reports that Facebook, the social media platform founded by Mark Zuckerberg 17 years ago, is planning a rebrand. The platform has 2.8 billion daily users, but it's currently facing a huge PR crisis after tens of thousands of documents were leaked by a former employee who also gave damning testimony to US senators, saying the company put astronomical profits before people. Well, joining me is Josh Coles, a researcher at the University of Oxford's Internet Institute. Josh, can we start by looking at Facebook's crumbling reputation? I mean, this began with the Cambridge Analytica scandal 3 years ago, and it's just had this latest document drop. What can you tell us?
Yeah, good morning, Georgina. That's absolutely right. Facebook has been on a downward trajectory, at least in terms of its public reputation and its reputation amongst policymakers as well, at least since that Cambridge Analytica scandal. Of course, its revenues and users and all the other important metrics that it cares about have continued to rise. So whether this final watershed moment with this release of documents and findings from this whistleblower is maybe the final nail in the coffin for Facebook's promise to really serve the world and bring us all together, that may well be the case. But how that plays out in sort of both policymaking, regulation, and of course the court of public opinion is something that I think this rebrand is trying to influence.
Absolutely. So what do they plan? Do we have any detail?
Well, it's pretty sketchy at the moment. A report from The Verge suggests that Facebook may lean into the terminology of Horizon as a basis for its new name. This might be linked to its plans to try to develop and be a leader in the development of the metaverse, which is essentially itself a rebrand of VR, virtual reality and augmented reality, which Facebook has been trying to pioneer on. So it's clear to see that I think that Facebook is keen to move away from its traditional offerings in terms of social media, precisely because those social media platforms do allow or do give rise to the kinds of social issues that we've been seeing for so long now.
And there have been precedents for this kind of rebrand before.
That's right. In 2015, Google transformed itself overnight into Alphabet, which became the name for its holding company. And then Google continued in its current capacity, primarily as a search engine. That was a recognition at the time that Google, the holding company, had far outgrown the original product offering as a search engine. But I think this case is a bit different as well. I mean, at that time, Google was kind of essentially led by a triumvirate of executives who each in the years since kind of moved to Alphabet and then quietly stepped away from the company. I don't think Zuckerberg shows any sign of doing that at all. If anything, I'd imagine he'd retain control, certainly of this new holding company, but also of Facebook itself. Although many of Facebook's subsidiaries like Instagram and WhatsApp do have their own leaders, I think Zuckerberg will clearly remain the final authority for all of them.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of Facebook's problems, of course, is that that there is a lot of false information that comes out there. And so it's ironic to see that a new company is being launched by Donald Trump called Truth, which promises really to probably be anything but.
Yes, exactly. Called Truth Social, may as well be called Trump Social, I think, because this is a plan by the former president to provide himself a platform to discuss, well, I suppose whatever is on his mind that day, much as he did when he was in office and tweeting. Of course, this is ultimately a reaction to his banning by Twitter and Facebook in the days following the Capitol riots. He was allowed essentially full access as a full user of those platforms prior to that and through almost his entire presidency. And actually, it was those platforms which in the first place gave him a chance to really make moves in the Republican nomination when nobody took him very seriously. So this has an interesting historical parallel to it. Of course, the fact that it's his own network means that it will be, I think, under great scrutiny for its fairness, the promised fairness and openness that the platform has pledged to respect, particularly compared with Facebook and Twitter in their eyes, which are supposedly overly censorious hating truth and everything else. So it is an interesting move by the former president. Whether it catches on is, of course, going to be the big issue going forward.
Yeah. And I wonder, though, with Facebook, I mean, can a rebrand, how does a rebrand help it in terms of policing that truth telling and the fact that it is being accused of really corrupting so many young minds?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the very short term, it's an interesting news story, maybe a good news story for them at a time when, as you say, they're just getting so many bad news stories at the moment. Even just today's headlines, they've been banned £50 million by the UK's competition watchdog and $15 million by the US Department of Justice for various ills. So it does provide a chance for a clean slate, I think, at least in the public eye. But ultimately, the services that people are going to continue to use are the social networks that Facebook provides. This quoted metaverse, which it hopes to maybe pivot towards, is quite a way off. So it does mean, I think, that Facebook still has a lot of trust to rebuild, or whatever it decides to call itself.
And just very quickly, Josh, what's a metaverse?
Good question. I think it's essentially a rebrand in itself. I think it's a combination of virtual reality and augmented reality that will allow us to socialize and work together remotely, which of course we've all got quite good at doing over the pandemic. But I'd take a chance for Facebook to change the conversation a bit as well.
Josh, thank you very much indeed. That was Josh Coles. And that's all we have for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Paige Reynolds and Daniel Bache, our researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our studio manager, Louis Allen, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist returns at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.